6, and 8, and I will badge you the name, Savalski Retail Ventures, versus JGB Vegas Retail LLC. If you wish to reserve time, please so state, and when you're ready.
May it please this honor of the court, John Bailey from Bailey Kennedy on behalf of the appellate Swarovski. Mr. Chief Justice, if I can reserve 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
The issue before this court is an issue of first impression here in the state of Nevada. It would be an issue of first impression in every state in this country. And the issue is, can a non-anchor tenant be enjoined from leaving a commercial shopping center, number one? And if so, can a court enjoin a non-anchor tenant without any evidence of irreparable harm? That is precisely what the lower court in this case did. After a 9-day evidentiary hearing, where the court did not find that Swarovski was an anchor tenant, the judge entered an injunction enjoining Swarovski from leaving the Grand Bazaar shops without any evidence of irreparable harm.
Mr. Bailey, if I can go to, you know, I hadn't read this record in the lease, and the Judge Gonzalez made 61 factual findings there. It appeared to me that were findings included irreparable harm. So could you tell me why you feel there isn't evidence of that in the record?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Let me just say that the court did not cite any authority for the proposition that what she called us as a sponsor would somehow inure to allowing her to enjoin a non-anchor tenant. The principal case relied upon by the respondent, the landlord below, and the principal case relied upon by the landlord in this appeal is the case of Massachusetts Mutual versus Associated Dry Goods. And in that case, and this is the case, the irreparable harm analysis of that case, in that case, the Ayers department store was the tenant. And the landlord, in the case that the court noted this specifically, the landlord provided evidence of the following. Number one, that tenants would not have leased space, existing tenants would not have leased space in the shopping center but for the Ayers department store being there. In our case, there was no evidence of any tenants saying that they would not have leased space in the Grand Bazaar shops but for the fact that Swarovski was there. Number two, existing tenants would not renew. There was evidence in the Ayers case that existing tenants would not renew their leases if the Ayers department store left the shopping complex. There is no evidence in our case of any existing tenants saying that they would not renew their leases. In fact, the only two tenants that testified in our case testified that they could care less whether Swarovski was in the Grand Bazaar shops or not, and they did not lease their space based on whether Swarovski was there, and they could care less if we left. Number three, in the Ayers case, the court noted that there was evidence and testimony that tenants in that shopping complex had provisions in their lease agreements that if an anchor tenant left, they would have the right to terminate their lease. In our case, the principal and the manager of the Grand Bazaar shop, the landlord, testified that there were no tenants in this complex, or lessees in this complex, that had the right to terminate their leases or licenses if Swarovski left. Number four, in the Ayers decision, the court specifically noted that prospective tenants came in and testified that they would not sign leases with the landlord if the Ayers department store was not there. In our case, there was no evidence of prospective tenants who said, we will not sign up and sign leases with the Grand Bazaar shops with the landlord if Swarovski is not there. And finally, in the Ayers case, the court noted that the landlord put on evidence of patrons to the shopping complex who specifically testified that they frequent and shop at the Ayers department store, and that if the Ayers department store was no longer there, they would no longer frequent the shopping complex. In our case, the landlord testified that there's 20 million people a year walking down the sidewalk of Las Vegas Boulevard and Flamingo, where the Grand Bazaar shops are located. They did not put on one piece of evidence that those 20 million people would somehow not be walking up and down Las Vegas Boulevard if Swarovski was not at that location, or that any of those people, those potential patrons, would not frequent the shopping complex if Swarovski was not there. There was a complete lack of any evidence to suggest that the landlord would suffer irreparable harm if Swarovski were not there. What the landlord did testify to was that in his opinion, if Swarovski was not there, that could be devastating. His words, that could be devastating. No corroboration, no other evidence, and as this court well knows, a pronouncement of something that is speculative and remote does not satisfy their burden of showing irreparable harm. The harm has to be actual and it has to be imminent. In this case, there is no evidence in the record of irreparable harm.
Okay. Thank you.
So, the point here is that the error committed below was that the...
Well, Mr. Bailey, could I ask you a question about what you just said? I was reminded of the findings by the district court that commenced roughly at 20 through 32, with 31 being a finding that this is a unique situation because of the Starburst issue in the license agreement. 31 says the Starburst is unique. 32 says the Starburst is considered the centerpiece and crown jewel of the GBS and is a central part of the identity of and draw to the GBS by drawing much of the attention by the Starburst. Now, I recognize your point that there isn't another finding that identifies a tenant who wouldn't sign up because of the Starburst, or a tenant who wouldn't elect to renew because of the absence of the Starburst. But what I infer from the findings that the judge has made is that this attraction, if you will, is a key component to the marketing of the GBS. Should that be viewed, or why shouldn't that be viewed as a basis for irreparable harm?
Thank you for asking that question, Justice Hardesty. In order to have irreparable harm, a movement would have to demonstrate that without that tenant, or in this case, without that Starburst, that somehow that money damages are inadequate measure to compensate them for that loss. Mm-hmm. Let me point you to the actual license agreement that we exercise our early termination provision. You have a license that's a 10-year license that has an early termination clause that allows Swarovski to terminate within the first year. And it has an ongoing termination right for the remaining 9 years of the license. In that termination provision, it's provision 26.1, if we exercise our right to terminate, the parties expressly agreed that we would have to leave and take all of our personal property, including the Starburst. So when you ask the question, which is a great question, the judge mentions the Starburst in that it's unique. It is unique. The parties agreed under the license that if you exercise your early termination rights, you have to take the Starburst with you. So why is that important? That's important because if you want to try to hook in any kind of irreparable injury or irreparable harm, that language would not be in 26.1. What it would say is, if you exercise your early termination rights, the Starburst is so important to the identity of this complex that you're required to leave it. You can't take it with you. A landlord, if that were the case, a landlord would have language like that. That does not, however, Justice Hardesty, overcome that Swarovski is a non-anchor tenant. There is no authority that's out there. I certainly haven't seen it, and they haven't cited to any of it, because there isn't any that somehow suggests that marketing materials or being a sponsor or having a Starburst that the landlord admitted in the evidentiary hearing can be replaced and they can find another sponsor somehow inures to the level of giving you the right to seek extraordinary relief like injunctive relief. Just isn't there. I think that was my...
Could I follow up on that point?
Yes.
I noticed that maybe it was just by argument, but I wanted to see what the testimony was in the record, and I haven't had a chance to read this, but it is a very interesting issue. Was it the other two tenants, I believe it was Wahlburgers and...
Giordano's?
Yeah.
Yes.
That those were actually the attraction for, because of their...
That is
the nature of their business. For was that in the record?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Could you expand on that a little bit, please?
I'd be happy to. In the ground lease between the owner of the property, which is a Bally subsidiary, and the landlord, they've identified, and this is in the record, they've identified four anchor tenants. They call them draw operators. The four draw operators comprise a little bit over 30% of the gross leasable area of the complex in the back of the shopping complex. Those draw operators, based on the language in the lease between them, are supposed to be restaurants. Not retail operations, not Swarovski, not specialty stores, restaurants. The two of those restaurants, through the time of our evidentiary hearing, were supposed to be Giordano's and Wahlburgers. At the time we exercised our early termination rights, they were not open and operating. But those are the two draw operators that the landlord agreed would be the anchors of this operation.
And there does appear to be a difference in the language in their lease and the language in your lease, hours of operation versus the subtenant's acknowledgement of continued operation in their leases.
That is absolutely correct. The testimony during the evidentiary hearing was, in our license agreement, there's a provision, it's in section 13, it's called hours of operation. It essentially says you need to be open from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m., 7 days a week, and if you're not, there's a liquidated damage penalty of $250 a day. Mm-hmm. That provision, identically or substantially identical, is in every license and every lease at the Grand Bazaar shops. However, in the four draw anchors or the draw operators, they have a continuous operation provision which speaks to, and I can read you the language, but it speaks specifically to those operators being so important to the center because they draw other tenants, because they affect percentage interest on leases, and that the quality and operation that they bring is essentially such that they're not like the satellite operators like Swarovski or the specialty stores, that they have a special character because they are the draw operators.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
I was just going to say that that provision is nowhere to be found in our license.
Why should this court adopt the distinction between an anchor tenant and a non-anchor tenant in deciding these preliminary injunction questions? It's an issue of first impression, maybe broader application in the rest of the country. Why should we venture out beyond the Massachusetts federal court's analysis?
Because if you did, you would essentially be eviscerating contract law between landlord and tenants. What you would effectively be doing is allowing any landlord to seek injunctive relief, in this case without any irreparable harm proof, but you would be allowing any landlord to seek injunctive relief at any time any tenant wants to leave the shopping complex short of the natural term of their lease.
So the policy reason for adopting a anchor versus a non-anchor rule here, in at least injunctive relief context, is that this should only apply to anchor tenants, this ability to enjoin, because someone, a yogurt shop, for example, couldn't leave potentially.
That is absolutely correct. The law in this state, the law in every state in this country has always been that only anchor tenants are potentially subject to injunctive, being enjoined from leaving. But there has to be irreparable harm demonstrated. There are plenty of cases that say that anchor tenants were not enjoined because they couldn't, because the landlord could not demonstrate irreparable harm.
Thank you. Chief, if I may, maybe we can give him a couple extra minutes.
But do you have another question?
I do, just a simple question. My understanding is that a good part of the case law...
I can't see
you. Excuse me. My understanding is that a good part of the case law across the country has indicated that an anchor tenant analysis is merely one theory of irreparable harm, and the judge did make findings here. Can you just address that briefly?
Yes, the judge did not point to any of the cases. I have not seen any cases that make a distinction between an anchor tenant and some other kind of tenant when it comes to irreparable harm. You nonetheless have to demonstrate as the landlord, if you're seeking injunctive relief, that the loss of that tenant over and above your ability to get money damages for breach of contract would somehow cause you some additional type of harm.
Right, and I'm focusing just on the anchor tenant aspect, as Justice Hardesty just discussed. Is that necessary when you look at the case law around the country, in the sense that it's only one factor to be determined in the irreparable harm analysis?
If you're asking me the question, do the cases make a distinction between an anchor tenant and some other type of tenant, you're shaking your head.
No.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
My point is, the anchor tenant issue is simply one factor to consider when you consider irreparable harm.
In the context of landlord-tenant law and a landlord seeking to enjoin a tenant, then the very first factor that must be satisfied is that the tenant is an anchor tenant. There is no case that I'm aware of, and they certainly haven't cited any, and the lower court didn't cite any, that would somehow suggest that not being an anchor tenant would nonetheless give you the ability as a landlord to seek injunctive relief.
Okay.
If you could somehow demonstrate irreparable.
Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, we're going to give you four additional minutes for rebuttal. When that comes back around, and Mr. Bice will extend your time by 4 minutes.
Thank you.
And with that, Mr. Bice.
And Mr. Bice, I know you've got a lot to say on this today, so I'm sure. Maybe my question I asked Mr. Bailey about this irreparable harm, the 61 findings. My take on these findings were that the Starburst was major piece of her analysis on the irreparable harm. So if you agree or disagree with that, I'd be interested in that and when you discuss irreparable harm.
No, I don't. Just again, may it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I don't disagree that that was certainly a component of the district court's ultimate sort of the factual matrix by which the district court found that there was irreparable harm here. But I do want to, I think, start at the beginning premise here. I think that there is some conflating here of what the word anchor tenant means with what irreparable harm is. Anchor tenant concept, at least in this court's decision in the Smith's Food King case, is about whether or not there is a duty of continuous operation that the law essentially implies by virtue of the fact that you were such a central component to the shopping center that the court will imply, even though you didn't expressly bargain for one, you will imply that that was part and parcel of the deal. In this particular case, the issue about whether there is a duty of continuous operation was expressly set forth in the lease. There's no question that they made that agreement. So I disagree with my colleague that this is somehow some precedential case of grand significance. This is an ordinary lease case applying the traditional rules, the traditional standard for preliminary injunction, i.e. irreparable harm, balancing of the interests, balancing of the public interest, was there a showing likelihood of success on the merits? And under this court's precedence, the district court is accorded a good deal of discretion on preliminary injunctions for good reason, and particularly in a case where the district court over the span of multiple days, more than a week, heard live testimony, heard evidence, considered the documents, and then made a decision and made it some very detailed, lengthy findings of fact and conclusions of law on a preliminary injunction standard. I would submit that based on this record, there can be no suggestion that the district court has somehow abused its discretion relative to a preliminary injunction.
Did the judge write these findings herself, or did your office submit them?
Like all matters, my recollection of the record, just given this, is that we submitted proposed findings to the district court. The district court entered its own findings based upon what the parties had submitted as competing findings of fact and conclusions of law. I do not recall doing a comparison. I know that I do know this for a fact. She rejected several of our findings that we thought were appropriate, and she certainly disagreed with Swarovski's proposed findings as well. So ultimately, this is the end order is the product of the district court's determinations.
Okay.
Turning to the real issue here is the lease provides a duty of continuous operation. I disagree with Mr. Bailey's characterization of it. That's just an hours of operation provision. Actually, the first sentence of it specifically says that it is they agree to continuously operate and they're only allowed to be closed for 2 days out of a year. And then there's a whole separate sentence that talks about what those hours of operations will be. So to suggest that, well, all this is just an ordinary hours of operation provision is rewriting the terms of the lease. They agreed expressly to a duty of continuous operation. Now, where does the court draw the line about when someone makes that deal? And then as the court can enforce it under a preliminary injunction. Mr. Bailey used the example of a yogurt shop. I'll use the example of assuming you had a 7-Eleven. If 7-Eleven had agreed to a duty of continuous operation and express lease, would the landlord be entitled to a preliminary injunction? All else being the same, my assumption would be probably not, because there's nothing unique about it. It can easily be substituted out. One would not, unless there was extraordinary facts and circumstances that would show that it was a draw or it served some particular role other than being just an ordinary tenant, then one would think you probably would never have satisfied the burden required to obtain a preliminary injunction. No showing of irreparable harm, no showing of the balance of the hardships. But that's not these facts. This is not an ordinary tenant. Whether they want to use the word, the label anchor or not, the district court analyzed the actual facts, the actual role of this tenant, and recognized that elimination of this tenant
would cause irreparable harm. And there's substantial evidence in the record that shows just why the district court was entitled to draw that conclusion. First of all, this Sikorsky was specifically referenced in all the marketing materials to prospective tenants. The landlord here would have run into the argument by many of these tenants that if they had been pulled out, that they had somehow been misled about who was going to be in the shopping mall. The evidence also showed that prospective tenants were specifically told about Sikorsky's role. It also serves as the nightly entertainment for the entire shopping center. That's the whole point of this Starburst and why the district court placed great significance on it. As the court can imagine, along Las Vegas Boulevard, particularly in the evenings, competition for customers is pretty aggressive out there. The whole point of the Sikorsky Starburst is that is the draw. That's why it functions every night and it provides an entertainment part of the showcase. And that's what the district court found. This is not some ordinary yogurt shop or 7-Eleven. Then what the district court also heard was Mr. Siegel, the testimony of Mr. Siegel. And the district court is certainly entitled to credit his testimony. With a lot of years of experience in operating these types of shopping facilities, testifying that the loss of Sikorsky under these circumstances would be devastating for them all. Because, and that's why it's not just a tenant, it was a co-sponsor. That's why it has a licensing agreement. It is a co-sponsor of the entire facility. That's why it was given its position in the mall. And that's why, yes, a lot of the draws, what being characterized with the landlord, or the draws are in the back. You know why? Because the landlord is balanced. The landlord wants those customers to migrate towards the back of this mall and then right into their hotel after the fact. But that does nothing to diminish the role that Sikorsky plays relative to this shopping center and relative to the agreement that it struck.
Could the Starburst be replaced if, assuming Sikorsky left, couldn't the landlord just put in a new light display like that and do the same thing as they're trying to do with the Sikorsky Starburst?
Well, let's just give my two sort of responses to that. Number one, I think the evidence would support the district court's conclusion that the answer to that is no, for the following reason, because Sikorsky is a brand in and of itself. It's not just a generic Starburst. It's a Sikorsky Starburst, and that carries grand significance. It's part of the branding of the entire center, and that's why it is. It's not just referred to as the Starburst. It's referred to as the Sikorsky Starburst. And that's also a number. We're here on an appeal of a preliminary.
And this wasn't consolidated?
For the trial on the merits. No, the trial on the merits, I think, in fact, the district court is planning on holding that in a couple of months. So ultimately, whether or not at the end of the day what the district court ultimately decides to do in terms of the ultimate remedy isn't before this court right now.
The only understanding from the record, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that when the TRO was originally entered, the judge increase the security for the TRO/preliminary injunction. So what's the status of that at the moment?
That security, I believe, has increased. And in fact, my client is sort of suffering here, and they're not being required to pay rent. I mean, they're essentially operating there because there is a dispute. They are, to the extent that they are paying it, in my recollection, is through an escrow account. So my client's not even getting the use of any money right now while they are operating on its property. It has to ultimately win the case to then obtain the funds. And if it doesn't win the case, well then Sikorsky will have operated there during the term of the preliminary injunction for free. yes, sir.
Go ahead. Did you finish your thought?
I did.
I think if I understand Sikorsky's argument in this appeal, though, on the issue of irreparable harm as discussed in Dixon versus Thatcher.
Yes.
Why is the findings related to the Starburst, its presentment, its light show, so to speak, its attraction to the Las Vegas Strip, why isn't the absence of that compensable? What is it about it, if it were removed, that can't be addressed through adequate alternative for damages, compensatory damages.
Yeah, I think, Justice Marcia, there's really two points to this, right? Number one, invariably, if the court were to allow them to remove it, they would invariably be able, they would claim calculation of those damages is speculative, because they would say, well, there are other attributes that cause the decline in revenues, or there are other injuries. So therefore, you always run into the problem of the harm becoming very difficult to calculate.
I get that point, but isn't that a necessary component under Dixon versus Thatcher to the finding of irreparable harm, that the damages that would result from turning off the lights, calling out the sign, are not compensable?
I don't think so, Justice Hardesty. I don't think that there's a requirement under this court's precedence that the district court specifically state that monetary damages are difficult or would be difficult to calculate. What the district court here recognized is, and I think a fair reading of its findings as a whole are, that due to the uniqueness of this particular tenant's role in shopping centers, and based upon the evidence that it heard, including from Mr. Siegel, who is, you know, based, and the court is entitled, the district court was entitled to credit his testimony, is this would have a devastating impact on the shopping center. They had pending agreements out with other customers at that point in time. Had those, Swarovski been allowed to just, one of the core of this shopping center, been allowed to bolt at the last minute, that could have a devastating impact on future deals and people who were willing to come in and operate there. This was, again, part of the marketing aspect of the entire center, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Bass, what are we to do, though, with, I noted that there was, the licensee was also gives JGB complete automatic ownership of the crystal if the agreement is terminated based on their fault. Also has, they also have the right of first offer of purchase of the crystal.
Yes.
So ultimately we come down to whether or not there was a validity for the leaving or a non-validity as to the crystal, which seems to be the irreparable.
Well, I think that the crystals, the crystal and the role it serves, it's not just the crystal, it's not just the physical crystal on itself, but it's also the role that it serves that constitutes that the basis for the district court's finding of irreparable harm, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, you seem to be emphasizing that, you know, the critical point of them being there is this light show.
Yeah.
And if they're leaving and they're at fault, then the crystal can stay and your client has use of it. But if they can show their other issues as they have alleged, then that goes with them.
Well, that I think, but Mr. Chief Justice, it's not just the physical crystal, right? I mean,
if it's not, then we go back to the question Justice Hardesty asked as to whether the financial considerations are sufficient.
No, and I guess maybe I'm not being sufficiently articulate here in what I'm trying to explain. The physical crystal in and of itself is certainly a part of it, but it's also the branding that goes with it. Swarovski's name is very, very significant in this realm. And the fact that it's that crystal, they're there, they made the agreement.
Would it cease to be their crystal if they leave?
But we no longer have the right to use their branding if they leave. And that's a significant difference. We're now talking about, well, we've got this crystal, but they're no longer affiliated with it. And they had made an agreement that as long as we did not default, and as long as they were not, you know, if they defaulted, they could not depart and leave the rest of the shopping center exposed on that. And so, again, at a preliminary injunction stage, we submit the district court is well within its discretion, and to credit the testimony of the witnesses that said that the departure of this licensee, co-sponsor, would inflict irreparable injury on the center. Yes,
I have a question, and it's a bit off topic, but in the appellant's brief, they quote at page 32 the language from the Wahlburgers and Giordano's lease, their continuous operation clauses.
Yes.
And in them, there's a contractually negotiated acknowledgement by those tenants that the continued operation is of the utmost importance to the project and other occupants, and it continues that it's important to the renewal of other leases, renting of space, and so forth. So those two tenants expressly acknowledge that, and with that acknowledgement comes some of the obligations that you're arguing here Swarovski also shares. Your answering brief alludes to a different clause of in their lease that doesn't contain those same acknowledgments and recognition. Rather, just say that the continued operation is important and agreed to, which looks like you have to be open during the business hours that you say you're going to be open to me. So the difference between those leases, to me, lends some credibility to Mr. Bailey's point, and I'd like to hear your comments on that because I didn't see it in the brief.
Yes, just figuring our response to that is this ties back to the original lease with the landlord. There's two separate agreements here. You've got the landlord lease. We are a tenant under that lease, right? Bally's has certain objectives as the landlord, as the property owner, that it wanted to accomplish. And one of those things it wanted to accomplish was it wanted to draw, it's its property, as the court, I'm sure, is familiar, you know, this is always was that long parking lot that was always out in front of Bally's for years. But it's Las Vegas Strip property. So what's the best way to make an economic use of that property? But use it to also then draw your people into the hotel and casino. So the reason that their lease is structured as it is, specifically requiring restaurants, and specifically requiring them to be at the back, is for that very purpose. The landlord, the property owner, has a certain objective. My client, who is the tenant of the, and then is licensing out the rest of the property for various purposes, also has objectives that are in addition to the objectives that the landlord balance ultimately has. And those objectives are to not just have tenants at the back that are drawing business into Bally's, but also have tenants in the rest of the mall. And for our purposes, Swarovski was one of those keys. For our purposes, the provisions that you're talking about are really for the protection of Bally's ultimately. For our protection, we had an agreement with Swarovski that they would agree, they agreed, that they would be in continuous operation throughout the term. It actually says throughout the term, except for 2 days a year. They made that agreement. So the only question then becomes, is Swarovski the equivalent of a 7-Eleven or a yogurt shop, using Mr. Bailey's, or is it something more fundamental such that the district court could find, based on the evidence, that its departure would inflict irreparable harm?
But shouldn't there be a contractual acknowledgement of that undertaking in the agreement with Swarovski, particularly given that other tenants, albeit on the Bally's, the food tenants, the anchor tenants, were expressly acknowledging that, you know, you're in for a penny and for a pound, you really are important to this, so you're going to have to stay?
Well, Justice Pickering, the answer to your question is, in other words, do a party have to expressly give a recital?
That's a good rephrasing.
In order to be bound to the covenant of continuous operation? And my answer to that would be no. Remember, we're talking about really two separate things here. The preliminary injunction standard or the injunctive relief standard is a legal question that the courts have imposed. Here, the parties have bargained for that duty. The only question that's presently before the court is, will the court enforce that duty by a preliminary injunction?
But you have to show irreparable harm, not compensable adequately by damages.
That is true. But that would be true even if that provision specifically was, even if you had a contractual recital, it would be evidence that there was such irreparable harm.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be per se satisfy the court's requirements. In fact, there's lots of authority out there that says the parties cannot contractually impose an agreement on the court that it must enter some sort of
agreement. No, I understand that. Thank you.
So that's our point. And yeah, I see that I'm out of time.
Any initial questions, Mr. Weiss, before he goes? Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
I thank you for your time, Justice.
Thank you.
Justice Pickering, the last comment you made about the continuous operation clause, that's an agreement between the landlord, JGB, and Giordano's and Redburgers. It's not an agreement that includes Bally's. So that whole argument about, oh, this is Bally's requirement, no, this is in the lease agreement between JGB, the landlord, and Giordano's and Redburgers. Let me answer a couple questions that came up in your question with Mr. Bice. First of all, when you, I think it was Justice Gibbons, asked, well, did the lower court prepare its own findings or did it ask the parties? We submitted proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. The specific finding that deals with irreparable harm, which is conclusion number 12, comes specifically out of their proposed findings of fact, but the lower court deleted the word anchor because that's what they proposed us to be and put in the word sponsor. So after a 9-day evidentiary hearing where the principal issue before the court was whether or not Swarovski is an anchor or not, because no anchor, no injunction, the court did not find that we were an anchor, but instead used this word sponsor. Next point. You asked the question, I believe, Justice Gibbons, whether or not the Starbirds could be replaced. The testimony from the landlord's principal was, yes, it could be replaced. And I remember asking Mr. Siegel on examination, and this is in the record, couldn't you put a different sponsor? Answer, yes. And I said, you could put Starbucks on the side of the Starburst pole that goes up instead of Swarovski. Yes, you could put something other than a Starburst crystal from Swarovski up there. Yes. The answer, can it be replaced? Of course it can be replaced. Mr. Bice just said that the court considered, I think he said evidence, but he said the court considered or they provided evidence that there were prospective tenants who, had Swarovski not been there, those prospective tenants would not have signed leases. There is zero evidence in the record of any prospective tenant coming in and testifying that they would not sign a lease with JGB and Swarovski or the event or the sponsorship was not there. Zero evidence in the record. So Mr. Bice, when he says the court took this information in its decision to grant the injunction, zero evidence in the record. Finally, I would ask the court to please address the erroneous interpretation by the lower court of the October 19th letter. It's briefed, but I would ask you to pay attention to that October 19th, 2015 letter. That letter was delivered to us, Swarovski, 5 days before the expiration of the 180-day cure period with respect to our early termination rights. The court found in its decision that that letter constituted a notice of default. The letter speaks for itself. The court erroneously interpreted that letter because when you read that letter, the landlord was saying to us that a default took place back in February of 2015 and the 30-day cure period had already lapsed. And because the cure period had already lapsed, that we would be denied our contractual right to terminate early. That's what the letter says. It's not a notice of default. It's a notice telling us that we cannot exercise our early termination rights because a default took place back in February. The problem is the October 19th letter points to two documents, two emails, and portends that those were notices of default. Here's what actually happened. The author of those emails, who was a low-level employee of the landlord, director of marketing, sends an email, both emails, to one of our low-level employees, a director of marketing as well, asking about a value-in-kind schedule. The emails certainly don't comply with the notice requirements under the license, but when the author of the emails testified at the hearing, she said, those were not default notices. I don't even have authority to send default notices. So the two notices that the October 19th letter is talking about that says, you were put on notice way back here and you failed to cure within the 30 days and therefore you don't have termination rights, we would ask you to look at that because the lower court absolutely got it wrong, the interpretation of that letter. And it's critical.
And Mr. Bailey, I'll stop you right there. We're over time at this point.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
With that, this matter is kind of submitted.